What's going on? This is Timmy Two Times.
Hey, it's Rachel.
Hey, it's Jeremy, and welcome to our world.
What's going on, Mr. Solly Sol Sol?
Hey, what's up, everybody? Okay, on this episode, we're going to do something a little different. It is Memorial Weekend, so we're going to take a little pause from the activities we all have planned with our families and take a moment to remember those who've made the ultimate sacrifice for the freedoms we all enjoy. We've invited a special guest and friend to the show, Chief Master Sergeant Michael D. Cummings, U.S. Air Force retired. He's going to be sharing with us his experiences and tell us what Memorial Day means to him. All right, I'm your host, Saul, and this is The Salty Show. All right, Ray, give us some of that crazy Ray Chronicles. What do you got for us today?
Alrighty. So first off, something that I'm really excited about. There is a Taco Bell resort coming to California this summer.
I've heard about this. Taco Bell resort.
Yeah.
What do they do at a Taco Bell resort?
Well, so do you know when they do like mud baths and stuff? Instead of mud, they're going to use hot sauce.
Or Baja Blast. Or just bathing in Baja Blast.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to give them a Baja Mad Blast.
No.
Wait, oh, my
so
gosh.
What the heck?
So.
You eat. What? I don't get it.
It's only 18 and up, which I wonder why it's only 18 and up. Like, alcohol. That's a little odd. You think Taco Bell is like, I don't know. Like, when I think of fast food, I think of being
just
a kid.
Liability. It's like, yeah, 18 and up.
You're probably right.
Yeah, I'll just be dumb.
Can you bring a chihuahua?
Yo quiero Taco Bell. Yo quiero el bando.
You guys remember that commercial?
Yo quiero Taco Bell.
I was like, genius. I used to like this word.
So. The quotes are, everything from guest rooms to breakfast and poolside cocktails will be infused with a Taco Bell twist.
Wait. Taco Bell infused cocktails?
Yes.
Pass. That's a hard pass right there.
Could you imagine Baja Blast and vodka? Come on.
No.
It's like bacon flavored.
But
vodka.
They were also saying that they're going to have like pool inflatables that are in the shape of like the hot sauce packets.
That's funny.
And towels.
See, the towels. I was going to say they could probably do towels as those little packets.
Oh my God.
And there's going to be an endless supply of Doritos Locos Tacos.
An endless supply.
Oh my goodness.
So where are they building this?
And there's going to be California. New menu surprises. Yeah. California.
Where in California?
Like San Diego.
They should do the towels burrito shape, you know? Like that way when you wrap yourself in them, you look like a burrito.
There you go. I like it.
That'd be so
or like
cute.
A badly wrapped burrito.
So when is this shindig opening?
Supposedly the summer.
This what? Summer.
Dude, wow. We got to go. We got
to
go.
I would kill to go here.
So does it mention why they're doing it?
Honestly, doesn't say why.
So one of the things I know about Taco Bell is that they are definitely changing their business model. Like they're starting to open up like these Taco Bell cantinas that are basically Taco Bell. You can get the Taco Bell fast food. Plus they have a real, I guess, Mexican food menu and they serve booze in there.
And also you can get married
downtown.
There.
Yeah. Huh?
You can get married at the
I don't know
Vegas.
Anything about that.
Yeah,
you can get married anywhere.
Yeah,
yeah, it's Vegas.
It's kind of weird, but the
you
one
get
in
drugs
Vegas.
On the strip.
Yeah, well, but one of my old friends, got married there.
At the Taco Bell Cantina.
Yeah.
Old friend.
Word is that when you say do, it's got to be si.
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 Si, señorita.
Si, señor.
Si, señor. Si, señorita.
Oh,
si,
man.
Mami.
Oh, wow.
All right, so this next one, I can't deny that I probably wouldn't act in the exact same way.
Oh, dear Lord.
Spider scare leads to Georgia woman's van rolling into river.
I can see you doing that.
Oh, no. So, what happened?
I've seen her.
Well, how many spiders were there, first of all? Was it just one?
So, it was one, but I would imagine it's a big one.
She freaked out.
No, I would imagine it's the smallest thing ever, and it comes down from, like, the sun visor right in front of her, like, and she just...
Oh my God. Wow. But I've seen Rachel react to a bug. We were having yellow towel. I was like, hey, there's a bug right there. She flips out and she's doing like the crawl in the air type thing. I'm like, what are you doing? It's a little moth.
Dude.
No, I don't mess with moths. I don't like things that fly.
Oh my God.
What are those spiders called that when they bite you, they leave like a hole in that whole
ground?
The recluse. Yeah. Yes. My sister got stung by one of those.
Bit,
whatever.
Sting,
I don't know what it is.
Can't walk, whatever.
It's an insect.
Did it put a
same
hole
difference.
In
it? Yeah, dude. And then she had to be rushed to the hospital.
To the ER.
But it still got
so
really
what did
nasty.
They just cut the skin around it off and then sew it up? Is that
it causes
how?
Tissue necrosis. So
right.
You have to basically create like a huge perimeter around it because it kind of spreads.
Right,
quick.
So they clean it out real good and then cut away what they think is infected and sew it up. And
depending on how severe it is. So it's the same as like people that get like a
snake bit?
Necrosis in their foot, like if they're diabetic.
Like diabetics, yeah.
Yeah, so they have to really like create a good perimeter, otherwise it can return in other areas. So like after they get rid of that portion, if they don't get rid of all of it, it's like cancer almost, as horrible as it sounds, where wow. if you don't get rid of all of it, it'll kind of start to spread
right.
outside of that.
Is that kind of like a snake bite? Sorry.
Huh?
Don't they have to do that with snake bite or not?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
Mostly don't. Oh, usually ever, they have anti-venom like, nowadays.
Like for a while during like the Desert Storm and all those, when people were sending pictures or videos back.
Oh, those camel spiders?
Those camel spiders are huge ones.
I don't know if those are real. Real. I don't
They're
know.
Real. Really?
Oh, wow.
I man, would pee myself I if know. I saw one of those.
Can you get one? And
can
throw
I get
it
one?
On, and throw it on her because I really want to see her pee herself. Oh,
I would like to think that they're illegal.
It's terrible.
Well, there's
this bug is illegal here.
So, Chief Master Sergeant over here, he has experience with were they banana spiders?
Banana spiders? Wolf yeah. spider. We have a wolf wow. spider right now at the home, as big as my hand. My wife pets it. It's our baby on the
really?
Front porch.
Really.
Oh, wait. Are those, kills insects.
So she pets it?
So it's like daddy long legs then? Like how those are good spiders?
Oh, wolf spider? I wouldn't call it daddy long legs, but...
Like similar?
They're big.
Yeah, oh, so man.
One of the things with the daddy long legs, I don't know how we got on spiders, but the one thing about the daddy long legs is they're like really poisonous, but... Apparently their jaws are so small that mm-hmm. they can't break the skin.
Oh, you're
so yeah. you don't the poison doesn't get inside you when they
so you're
bite.
Like,
yeah, I'm friends with Daddy Longlegs. There's probably one of the few bugs that I'm okay with.
Okay, so wait, hold on. So she causes an accident.
Yes.
What?
Okay.
Did she die?
She didn't really cause an accident. So she was backing her Kia van down a boat ramp to put her kayak in the river, about 56 miles north of Atlanta. So she had her window down and a spider suddenly jumped in her lap, according to the state patrol. The frightened woman said she jumped out of the vehicle without putting it in park, and the van then rolled into the river and floated downstream a few feet,
Jesus.
And then it became totally submerged.
That's fucking
is
awesome.
Is there a video of this?
No, but...
Awesome. I'm sure that if you searched, you would find videos of stuff
What was
like
the
that.
Lady's name?
I want to look her say. Up. Oh, they did not say, but I would not blame her. I would abandon ship as quick as possible. But, I mean, depending on how big. If it's like a, I don't know. It'd have to be like a pretty decent sized spider, I would think.
The only thing that could do it to me is either a scorpion or a snake.
No, I've been stung by a scorpion. It's not that bad.
I've been
stung by a wasp in my like thigh while I was driving, and I was fine.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was in the seat.
Yeah,
I was stung by a scorpion three times. In the ass.
Mine was once in the butt too.
Oh my God.
Really?
No,
you
no,
had
no.
it once in the butt?
So listen to this story. No, because this is a true story. So I'm editing videos with my buddy. We're in my room and you know, we sit down to eat whatever. And when I got up, as soon as I got up, well, because I felt like this scratching on my shin,
right.
for like
yeah.
a, and pants. I didn't know what it was until I kept pulling my pants up, and I couldn't see it. It would get stuck in the creases yeah, whenever. Yeah. And anyway, so then I go to sit down, and this guy, I guess, goes behind on and as soon as I'm gonna sit down, I feel but I didn't feel the sting. I felt like electricity went through. Oh, no, okay. I felt like like my leg just went crazy, and I was like ah. And my buddy's looking at me like, you all right, man? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, my leg is about to give out. And he's like, oh, that's weird. And I went to go sit down again. And again, I felt like a shock.
Oh, my God.
And so by this time, I'm like, dude, something's wrong. Something's wrong. I'm thinking my leg is going, you know, losing.
Like sciatic?
Yeah, I don't know what it was.
I'm
so
then Elizabeth.
On the third time, I'm going to go sit down again. Boom, again. By this time, I'm like, something's happening. I take my pants off. So listen. So when I tell you that my buddy looks at me. He's giving me like this look. He's like, bro, you know, are you trying to come on to me? What is going on? Right.
I'm not that kind
and
of
I'm like, dude, I swear something. And as soon as we look on the floor, you see the scorpion. It's upside down and its tail is like a feet away. And you know it.
Oh,
the
tail popped off.
The tail ripped off, and it was just going like that. You know, like the legs moving. And my buddy freaks out, and he's like checking himself. He's like, "Oh my God, it's on me! It's on me!"
That's fantastic.
Oh my God! But yeah, and your tongue. Did your tongue get numb?
Mine didn't.
My tongue got numb. It was the weirdest thing.
Oh really?
Yeah. So then I'm googling, "Am I gonna die?" You know?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I've been stung twice. Once in the side of the foot, and
ooh.
Once in like the calf. I think you were there when I got stung that one time.
Oh, yeah. You were pissed.
I was.
Oh, he like screamed.
And I was less pissed about getting stung and more pissed about the fact that there was a scorpion in my house. It's like,
yeah.
God, you know, you just like, you feel kind of like violated, right? Like, How'd you get in here?
We just had this conversation.
Yeah. When I
crickets, like apparently.
Wasn't it you? Oh, yeah. Wasn't it you what? That we were all going out and you went to use my bathroom and there was a freaking scorpion in my toilet?
In the toilet?
In the
but
toilet?
Also, when I first moved to Arizona, our house, well, so it's a weird story, but these people built this house for them. Like they built an in-law, all this other stuff into it. And then they lived in it for about 3 months and then they moved out. Even though they owned it, they just put for sale by owner, live somewhere else. Like they refused to live in this house.
They built it on a scorpion nest, huh?
Well, possibly because it was infested with scorpions.
Okay.
But also there was like weird, creepy, like ghost stuff that was going on there, which was weird.
Ghost
but
stuff?
I know. I can't. Well, it would be like,
that's
it's weird. I know it sounds weird. But my closet had at least 100 baby scorpions in it, like about this big when I first moved in.
Oh my God. So one night I walked out the front door of my old house and just out the corner of my eye, I saw that there's a pillar right outside the door. And I was like, I walked out to the car to get something. I come back and I was like, there's something on there. I just out of the corner of my eye, I caught it. And I looked at it and it was two scorpions and they were fighting each other. They're like pushing each other up and down the column.
They're having a battle.
They're fighting for whatever, right? And so I'm like, all right, well,
It was their mating down.
The turf.
It may have been. Well, let me finish my story. So I go inside and I get a 24 ounce dead blow hammer. I don't know if you know what they are. They're like a, I don't know, maybe an inch and a half in diameter. So a big hammer.
And they're like the rubberish.
Wow. Yeah, they're kind of rubberish. Like and I go out there and I'm like, I'm gonna get both of these with one blow, right? I go and go bunk. And you see the two tails, all of a sudden they just start, you know, just like they die. And all of a sudden you see all these things falling to the ground and then they crawl away.
That's
the babies were on the back
of the mom.
of one of the scorpions. And when I killed the mom, they fell to the ground and they started scurrying around trying to get away.
By the way, that's the name of your sex tape.
And you're
two
never
with one blow.
Two with one blow.
Sorry.
Anyways, so you're never going to sleep again. So.
All right, no. But
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
Anyways. Well, so anyway, so nobody died. Good, right?
Yeah, nobody died. Jesus. Everybody was safe. She just lost her Kia.
Poor lady.
Man.
Did she get a ticket for it?
But was it really a loss?
I don't know. I mean, they didn't say it, but they reported it.
Sounds like a win to me.
Yeah. Sounds like a win-win, right?
Got rid of it.
Lost the kayak and the car.
Oh. So the last one is, so the whole reason I brought up this spooky ghost stuff is because this one is a little ridiculous. Malaysia has closed a hospital where people were intimidated by ghosts. So they straight up closed this hospital because enough people complained about it and like nurses became like obsessed with it and like would transfer.
What were they seeing? Like what was
happening? Well, they have different like reports. So like in 2007, a nurse reported seeing a strange black phantom, quote unquote.
Dead people?
No, just a phantom.
What
that they didn't. That's all the report says. And then in 2009, Nurse N, who was somebody different, initially did not report anything unusual. But after a while, she began to hear strange sounds and feel strange smells. That's odd. That must be a communication issue.
Yeah, translation.
Yeah. Then she saw a phantom, quote unquote, in the form of an elderly woman and another creature with a black face.
So they closed. They didn't even move it. They just closed it. They're like, okay, we're done.
Yeah, well, it's like numerous, over. And like patients wouldn't stay there. Like they would, would be like, okay, I'm leaving. Like I'm not staying here. Like
this was Malaysia.
Yeah, in Malaysia.
Was it a new hospital?
No, it's an older one.
It's been around for a long time.
An older one.
Somebody wanted that building really bad.
Yeah, somebody was freaking them out.
Who are you gonna call?
Setting up like holograms.
Really? Yeah. Somebody got a good deal, right?
Yeah,
maybe
it's on natural gas.
What exactly is a phantom? I guess I don't know.
I don't know
what that
either.
Means.
To be honest,
is that like
is that any different than a ghost?
Upper human, and then like the body, the lower part just kind of vapors off into.
I always just think like the silhouette of something, right? Like you know, you see the but you don't see their.
So there's no like facial features or anything like. It's just like a blurry.
Yeah.
Or yeah. Well, the Phantom in the Opera.
Well,
the TV program, The Phantom.
With
the big black hat and the black cloak.
Was it a comic
book? That's before your time.
Oh, the radio show.
Yes. Yes.
Wait, no.
No.
Who knows? What's the one?
Yeah.
Who knows?
You got it. You got it.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that one. I think they had a comic book for a brief period, too. I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. I think it was short. Anyways, apparently the definition is, first off, it's a ghost, but then the following one is a figment of the imagination.
Yeah, your mind's playing tricks with you, basically.
So which one is it?
So do you guys watch this show on Netflix? It's called Brain Games. It's actually really
no.
It's pretty
I've
good.
I've heard of it.
So
you told me about it.
Well, they talk about how especially when you're with a group, you know, you just collectively, you freak yourself out. And then so you start believing things and your mind starts playing tricks on you.
Okay.
Because, you know, you as a group have a consensus. And I think that's what happens here. You know, you build this like, oh my God.
We talked about that several episodes back about how, you know, when people, I think the example I gave was we were at work and, you know, in the corner, you thought you saw something. And when you actually went, you know, so I think what happens is when people see things, they get scared and they don't go investigate. But if they were to actually go and look at the situation, they'd be like, oh, well, that's just the, you know, the light from the outside shining on the whatever, right?
Exactly.
But they get scared and they're like, oh, and they run away instead of just looking to see what it is and basically legitimizing it. Or
so they do this. So they do this experiment. You know, the Ouija board, right?
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
So, and so the, in this experiment, they grab like some people who are agnostic to it, some people who really believe it, and then some people who are like, no, this is like, okay. And so when they sit them down, you know, the people who don't believe at all, and they have them, you know, play this and like, I'm not moving. Nobody's moving it.
Right.
And then they ask the spirit a question and then the spirit is answering. Right. And then what they do is they say, okay, everybody close your eyes and let's do this again. Mm-hmm. And then when they play the Ouija board, it's just random parts in the board and there's no logic to it. And it's like, do you still believe, you know,
it's like chaos magic. If you believe in something enough, then your subconscious will make it real.
Right.
Yeah. Other than that, that's all I got.
Do you believe in magic?
All right, now let's get to the meat and bones of the show, guys.
We have a very special holiday coming up, and it's not just the kickoff to the summer where we can barbecue and just have fun and have an extra day off of work. Monday is Memorial Day, and for a lot of people that might not know, Memorial Day is an American holiday observed on the last Monday of May, honoring the men and women who died while serving in the U.S. military. Originally known as Declaration Day, it originated in the years following the Civil War and became an official federal holiday in 1971. Each year on Memorial Day, a national moment of remembrance takes place at 3 p.m. local time.
Oh, okay, so wherever you're at.
At 3 p.m.
That's when you...
I did not know that.
I did not know that.
I did.
So when we had a conversation with Heidi last night, and that's what brought on this idea to, you know, invite her father. And she was very adamant about, you know, making sure that we understood the difference, right? Because on Memorial Day, we're commemorating those who sacrificed their lives, right? But one of the things that we obviously can't do is have an interview with those folks. So I think what we can do, and that's why we've invited Chief Master Sergeant Michael D. Cummings on the show, and is to go ahead and, you know, talk to him and find out how it is. Cause I don't think any of us in this room outside of him has served. Am I
correct?
Correct. Okay. So for me, I think this allows us the opportunity to be able to ask questions and, you know, about your experiences and all that. So, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me here. I appreciate it.
Definitely. So what branch of the military did you serve in?
I was in the United States Air Force for 22 years. I retired as a Chief Master Sergeant. Couldn't make any more stripes, so I said, hang it up. Yeah. So, Memorial Day, very important day, especially for those people that's been in the service a long time, because they understand and they've seen the sacrifice of their comrades, both male and female, by the way.
Yep.
But yes, it's a very, very
and
special
so
day.
Where did you serve in what years and what war, I guess?
I started in 1966, right out of high school. And I immediately went the next year to Vietnam and spent a year there. And then I came back to the States and went for a second tour in Vietnam.
So you enlisted. You weren't drafted.
I was enlisted.
What made you do that? What motivated you to
Cummings tradition. Civil War on, a Cummings has been in every major war in this country.
Wow, that is something to be proud of.
My father was a First World War veteran, Silver Star recipient, 3 Purple Hearts. I have a brother that was 2 Purple Hearts, Bronze Star.
Wow. Do you have the stories of what how they earned some of those?
That would get pretty in-depth, but
I think
my father would be the one you'd really want to hear about. He was in John Pershing, who was the commander of U.S. forces in Europe in the First World War. He was in his 1st Army, 1st Division, or 1st Infantry. He was at Samahill, Aragon Force, I can't pronounce it correctly, Chateau-Thierry, all the major battles, there's quite a few, when he got to the top of the hill in Saint-Mihiel and his group, I can't remember, I don't think he called it a division. It was, I can't remember what size, maybe a platoon. There was only two left out of 20-something.
Yeah. Wow.
And he came back and was able to share that experience.
Wait, you said awesome. Two left out of how many?
20-something men in the group.
Out of 27. Okay.
But there were there are many other groups, right?
Oh yeah. He was just one of many. Right. There was storm in the mountain.
Wow, that's insane.
Remember, the First World War was a offshoot of the previous wars in Europe where you had battle lines and you just kind of march at each other, which is kind of stupid. But that's what they did.
When did that change? I know that...
Shortly thereafter. For us, I think the Spanish-American War really changed that, but you know, which was before that. But when we got to Europe, of course, we were the new ones. Remember, Britain was already fighting in France.
Yeah, right. We came in late in the game.
And so we kind of just followed their lead and participated in the battles as they were. Which, in fact, I don't think that would have been the right cup of tea, but that's what they did.
Why did America eventually join the cause, and what was it that got
us? The ship went down with Americans on it.
And so then the country united.
That fired us up. Because back then we had a lot of patriots in this country, almost every citizen.
Yep.
I could talk about today, but I won't. But
we're all there with you.
That's I think, was the driving force.
So you served in the Vietnam War, and so when you came home, I know that there's that may have been one of the most controversial wars, where there was a lot of protests. What was the experience like when you came back?
Ugly.
Did you feel the brunt a lot of that the obviously the country was divided, and there were hearings in Congress about, you know, ending this war. And it was very different than previous wars where servicemen and women would come back and they're celebrated. And this war was a little different. How was the experience coming back?
First, you don't really want to call it a war. It was actually a conflict.
Conflict, okay.
And it was not a war because it wasn't run by the military. We were driven by politicians.
Yeah.
And for instance, I was participating in one of the Tet offensives, and I had went temporary duty assignment to a base in Phang Rang, South Vietnam. And my job there was to take transit F-4s coming out of Thailand. We were having some electronical problems. We had to ship them over to Yokota, fly them into Yokota, Japan, to be modified, and they'd come back through. And myself and another gentleman would catch them and send them on through across the Gulf of Tonkin to Japan. While I was there, the South Vietnamese Army, which was not located there, our protectors for that base was the South Koreans, the Republic of Korea's.
Yeah.
Excellent military people, by the way. And they were hamstrung because the politicians decided that there is a Buddhist temple on top of this hill that they could not bomb, or we could not take out. And guess where our enemy was shooting at us?
Oh, they were right there.
And many rocks, or Republic of Korea military people lost their lives there. Wow. And I was working in a group. At that time, of course, the planes stopped coming in when they started attacking the base.
Right.
And so we were assigned to help medevac the people out, get them on helicopters and get all the wounded out.
Yeah.
And to see some of what we saw there, that's what Memorial Day brings back to me, the lost allies that I saw. Their lives there, where we tried to do our best for.
Were there a lot of casualties in your unit?
Not in my unit. I was a fighter mechanic. I worked on. Okay. I turned fighter. So most of my career was on F-4 Phantoms.
Okay.
And then after that, I was on multiple fighters, modern fighters. But at that time, it was F-4 Phantoms, and so sometimes we'd lose some of my comrades. But most of the F-4 people, we were in the back. We wasn't up in the front lines. The only time I ever actually went out in the field was when I was on the crash recovery crew, my second tour in Vietnam.
Ooh. How often did you go out to recover a crash?
I can't remember. Probably 15.
15 over 13, a 15. Year? Or
no, that was over a period of 7 months.
Oh, so you extrapolate that out to like 25 a year?
We would only go out if the thing did not explode upon impact. For instance, there was Marine bases along the DMZ, inland from the DMZ. DMZ is demilitarized zone up in the north.
And this is in Vietnam?
In Vietnam. In Vietnam, yeah. Same thing in Korea.
In Korea, exactly.
Yeah. Yep. And then along the Laotian border and the Thai border, Thailand's border, we had military outposts, and we had ARVN, which is the South Vietnese Army. We had outposts, and they had what was called as a PSP runway, which is a quick installed metal runway. And some of the aircraft, both F-4s, F-100s, A-1Es, A-7s, whatever, that got shot up and they were able to land on one of these PSP runways, they would call back to places like where I was at, Cameron Bay Air Base. And we would go out on a C-7A normally, or a helicopter, whatever is available, with tools and everything. The pilots would tell us the condition of the aircraft, and we'd do everything we could just to get it airborne and back to a base of some kind of friendly allied or, you know, U.S. base, just to save the aircraft. If we got there and it was too bad, we'd just blow it up.
Yeah. Wow. So you said you had siblings or...
Oh, yes.
Who were also in this?
Not in Vietnam. Vietnam, the only time I had a couple cousins that was over there. Okay. And, of course, high school comrades that graduated with me. But in the First World War, my father. Second World War was my brother. I had two other siblings in the Second World War in the service, but one of them was in Europe and the other one was at a hospital location. And then after that, my sister was in the Air Force. And then I was in Vietnam. I had two nephews in Iraq and Afghanistan. We had one family member that was in Grenada, whatever you call it.
Yep.
He was a Marine. I had an uncle that was a Marine.
Wow.
In the Second World War.
Yeah, it's a family of
family military.
Because even your kids, right? Your daughter.
My daughter's in the Air Force.
Yep.
Yep.
How did you stay in contact with family when you were out there? Letters?
There was post. Yeah.
Really?
Okay. When after I got married and I was overseas, and of course I had a couple of remote tours after that where my family could not, my immediate family, my wife and kids couldn't go with me. And there was a shortwave radio, and you'd call back on the radio at night, reserve a time, and you'd say, "How are you, honey? Over."
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Oh, that is, I did
that's
not know
awesome.
That.
Yeah.
So, that the technology was there at that time.
The local, you know, if you drive around Sun City, you'll see these big antennas in people's backyard.
Yeah, well, I've seen them.
That's ham operators.
Yeah.
And they're running radios.
Is that how, because I know, it's cliche, but the movie with what's his name,
Rob Williams.
Good Morning,
Morning Vietnam.
Yeah,
was he using the same type of technology with that radio?
Oh no.
Was that an actual radio station?
It called it AFN. It was Air Forces Network.
Yeah,
and Armed Forces. I'm sorry, not Air Forces. Armed Forces Network, and they're today operating Europe and in the Pacific Theater today, and of course it's limited. Entertainment, but there's a lot of news and things like that. They try to keep us abreast of what's going on at home.
This might be a dumb question, but was that based on a true story?
Adrian Cronauer, yeah, I believe he was.
Yes, it was based on.
Did you were you able to listen to him, or did you know about him?
Robin Williams.
Well, no, you know the guy who.
Oh, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
Really. He was.
You remember, I worked on a fighter base at Cameron Bay. We had three squadrons of F-4s there. Our job was to close air support and air superiority. Air-to-air to keep the bombers and the air transports from the north from coming down. MiGs, the Soviet aircraft, and Chinese. But when there was a major conflict, our job was to keep those F-4s turning, loaded, and out supporting the ground troops wherever they were. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, because of some of the politics involved, we lost a lot. I think a lot of Americans where we didn't have to.
Really?
Because we couldn't do our real job.
Right.
And that's why a lot of troops come back from Vietnam, and a lot of the citizens were upset because it just kept lingering on. Mm-hmm. You know, 10 years, and it just kept lingering on.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were being killed, and they're saying, why?
One of our longest war or conflicts? I think it was, right?
And that was technically one of the first ones, technically, that we lost. That was the first time.
Technically, we did.
Well, Korea War started that, and where there was no, you know, we did DMZ.
Right.
Then we go into Vietnam because people already irritated about Korea. And then now, you know, not even 10 years later, now we're starting Vietnam, basically doing the same thing over. And it was just right after World War II, everybody was really, oh, we got to stop them. Korea was good, but then towards the end of it, they're like, this is not good. With Vietnam, in the beginning, was it better received in the beginning?
Oh, yes.
You know, like, all right, we got to do this.
I think that was John F. Kennedy, right? It started John Kennedy, and then by the time it ended, I think it was Nixon.
Yeah.
And I think by then it
LBJ.
LBJ, right?
Oh, I thought it was Nixon who ended it.
LBJ, well, I think you're right, Tim. I think it was Nixon, because LBJ didn't get reelected. Nixon got in.
So I think, like you said, it was just a long, drawn out, and then just the country
conflict.
Did not have the... Right. The fortitude to continue that, right? One of the things none of us served, and so I know when I watch movies and, you know, Hollywood places their own, you know, version to certain stories, but a lot of times you see, you know, there's a lot of downtime when you're waiting for something and you just like the daily routine. How did you keep yourself entertained? What would you do during those times when there wasn't much action? For lack of a better term.
There was no downtime for an F-4 mechanic in Vietnam.
So you were nonstop.
It was 12-hour shifts. If we were in a conflict, you slept on the wing of the aircraft.
Wow.
They brought the meals to us, MREs, meals.
What did you eat?
MREs.
What was it?
Meals ready to eat. It's a package.
Yeah.
And back then they were in boxes, little cardboard boxes. And we had NF2, these Lydols with exhaust system. We'd heat up our beans and weenies on that and make our, we had a little can of bread that you would pop the top and put on there, and they gave us a P3. You know what a P3 is?
No.
Little can opener.
Oh,
you
the see little, them at little butterfly surplus. Looking thing. Oh,
yeah, they still something. They're great. Get one if you don't have one. P3, no. Army surplus, and it works on your keychain. And then we'd stay on that jet. 12-hour shifts every day.
No. So there
the only
was,
time
there
you
was
got
no
time
lull.
Off is when you would take a. If you were a good boy and are a good airman, we had ladies there too. Only in the nurses' corps.
Yeah.
At that time.
I get it.
We had candy stripers too, Red Cross workers. Yeah. They'd bring us Kool-Aid and cookies.
Candy stripers. Adorable.
But no, there was no downtime.
Did you get any chance to travel outside of Vietnam?
If you're good, you'd get a 3-day pass, and we call it rest and recuperation, R&R. And some of the guys actually jump the flight, go down to Sydney. But you'd only get there and only be able to spend a few hours. You had to get
Australia?
Back on the plane. Australia.
Yeah. Really? Wow.
You're on that side of the world.
How would you get there? Would you have to buy your own ticket? Or
military hops all the time. Australia was our ally. Right. They had aircraft in South Vietnam working with us. Matter of fact, at Phang Rang, when we were attacked that time, I was in a bunker right by the Australian, which is their version of B-57s at Canterbury.
That was the story you guys were talking about. A couple, you know, last year for your birthday.
With Jimmy and Art.
Yeah, when you were saying you had the damn pistol and you're just sitting, you know, shooting, you know, and you didn't know what was going on.
That was very nerve-wracking that night. We could not get to, see, the mechanics were not issued firearms on base. And so when the enemy overran the perimeter and got on base, we couldn't get to the armory to get our firearms. And so we just went to the bunkers with a 12-inch screwdriver, and security police and the South Korean army, our Marines, I'm sorry, were doing their job, and they cleaned up. They got, I think the body count for the enemy was 50-something on base.
Jeez.
That the security police took out, and at the perimeter, it was more than that. Now, of course, we suffered losses too, but...
How many countries were part of the Allied... forces that you interacted with? I know you said Korea.
Off the top of my head, I can think of four that I actually interacted with. And that was the South Vietnamese, Australia, and then the Koreans. Now, I knew that Britain had some folks in there, limited, and New Zealand has some folks in there. But that was the major.
There's a lot of
countries supported us. Yeah. Japan was a big support. They allowed us to fly the B-52s out of Okinawa.
Yeah.
And, well, at that time, Okinawa was not a Japanese island. It was ours.
Yep. Yeah. I forgot what I was going to say, but Did you pull any pranks on you got any stories
on allies or on my comrades? We pull a lot of pranks.
These stories are great.
What did you do?
Got to be careful in stories.
Something you can share.
Let me come back. Let me think about it in the back of my mind as I go, because there's a couple I can think of that would have been cool.
I have a quick question. Is there anything during the Vietnam War that would be considered classified that you're still not allowed to talk about, or is that time?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yes. There's things from there and all the way up to when I retired.
So how do you find out later that it's no longer classified and you are allowed to talk about it? You just never do?
Taking to the grave.
I'd have to go inquire.
You'd have to go to somebody and say, hey, is this still declassified?
So on that note, so having to hold on to a lot of that information, right? Can't tell anybody. When you're telling your stories with your buddies and everything, how do you remember not to slip, you know what I mean, by accidentally saying something you shouldn't?
You don't think about it. You block it out.
You know, I mean, I guess, yeah. I mean, it's no different than if you're really holding into something.
When I was young in Vietnam, very little classified that I was privy to.
It was later.
Later, and when I was in Europe as a chief, a senior in chief, I worked with, I did a couple classified missions, actually, where my family did not know where I was at.
And the Berlin Wall came down shortly after.
I can tell you time I had a mission twice to go to East Berlin and work with our allies, the Russians.
Oh, yeah.
And in Berlin. Remember,
people forget about that.
Exactly.
And it was interesting.
Hey, man. You know, hey, we say again, you know, we're not done by no means. But, you know, again, we want to, you know, salute you and thank you for your years of service. Because, you know, I've sat there and I met, you know, some of your buddies a couple years last year. And what was one of the hardest things for you being in the military? Like, emotionally, like what, you know, like, cause you know, based on, you know, Memorial Day and everything coming up, like what was the hardest day for you in the military? You know, of things you've seen.
I think that had the most impact on as far as in regards to Memorial Day was I was 19 years old. I launched my fighter and I sat on the pits is where you refuel them. They catch the aircraft and turn it. Mm-hmm. And the jet didn't come back, and I lost both the crew members. And their names on the wall. Yeah. And then I watched another of my aircraft go out, and the backseater, we had a mechanical malfunction in the runway, and the backseater was very close to me. His name was on the side of my aircraft, because I was the crew chief on the other side, and the pilot and the co-pilot. And for some reason, he got shook, and he hit the canopy release and ejected himself through the canopy, and I had to go out and help.
Wow. So
those two occasions stick in my mind the most about Memorial Day, because I think about those three people.
Do you have photographs of your time?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I've done a couple of presentations at elementary schools.
Oh, really?
When they ask us to. Of course, we have to sanitize the pictures, especially the one that says you are entering a VD area.
Me love you long time.
Oh my god,
me so horny. But people forget that's where that whole thing came from. That saying and that joking.
Yeah,
I think one of the things that you hear from people during that time, a lot of people kept diaries. Did you keep any personal diary during that time?
Not really a diary. I did annotate on pictures some things. I had a. What was the name of that camera? Bought it at the BX, base exchange. And I'd write on the back so I could remember later on where
was it
was
like a Polaroid where instant picture Polaroids?
Well, no, we had one of the, but I had a actual film, you know.
Oh, really?
So
you have video footage of
not when I say film, I'm talking about
like the 35
millimeter. 35 millimeter.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So nothing.
Back when film was film.
We didn't have a
Kodak was a company.
We didn't have a lot of video. But I had to open the back of the camera, you know, and roll the film.
That was so annoying.
Did you have to develop your own pictures as well?
No. We take them to the base exchange. It took a little while to get them back, and they would ship them off to one of the other locations, probably either in the Philippines or in Okinawa, and they'd develop them for us. And then ship them back. Took a while to get your film back. So you had to kind of time yourself. When you were getting ready to rotate back to the States, you wouldn't want to have any pictures out there in the pipeline.
Right. Now, you served in the first portion of it or towards the end of that conflict?
I was there 67 through 69 is my two tours in that period of time frame.
Your last day?
Vietnam?
Yeah. Yeah. How was that?
After I sobered up, I found my way to the Freedom Bird. Two airlines primarily funneled all of the troops in and out of Vietnam, Eastern and TWA at the time. And there was always 707s. And Cameron Bay was a departure point, Da Nang, and then Tan Son Nhut and Saigon. And that's where everybody rotated, Army, Marines, everything. I came out on that was Eastern. And we had a full aircraft. I think it was 165 people, if I remember correctly.
Was it mostly GIs going home?
Oh, it was all GIs.
All GIs.
Yeah, every once in a while we'd have a candy striper or a civilian on there, but very few. So we'd have some CIA and those kind of guys sometimes.
So when Eastern or TWA flew out of those airports, it was always all military?
Probably 98% military.
Okay.
And they called them Freedom Birds. They were only chartered by the government to funnel people in and out of Vietnam.
All right. So they were chartered by the government.
Yeah. Very rarely would we have any deceased in the hull. Sometimes. Most of the time they come back on the C-141s.
So when you said you went to Europe after that, and that's where you
came
gained
back from
the...
there. Yep. I went to, after I came back from Vietnam, I went to Korea. Matter of fact, I went to Korea while I was in Vietnam. I can't tell you why, but I went to Korea while I was in Vietnam.
Okay.
That was a young guy that didn't know what I was getting into.
Hey, but you know what? I mean,
I went to Korea. That was on a program called Team Spirit, which was exciting. We took, at that time, I was on F-15s, and we took a squadron over there to participate in some exercises.
Yeah.
And then came back from there and was stationed at Eglin Air Force Base. I was first in a fighter wing when I first came back to Vietnam, at Goldsboro, North Carolina, whoopee. But it was one of the three main combat fighter wings. So we trained we trained pilots who were already educated. They just had to learn tactics there. Mm-hmm. And we exercised some new programs on F-4Es, our newer fighter. And then I went to, I went down to Eglin Air Force Base, Florida.
Florida. Eglin is in Florida.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think it's in the Panhandle.
We
Fort
went
Walton
to
Beach.
North Carolina, right? There's a big military, they had ships out there. Where was this in North Carolina that we?
No, that was Charleston. Charleston.
South Carolina then.
Charleston, South Carolina.
Yes. Yeah. They had big ships out
there. That's more Navy.
Oh, it was. Oh,
my dad was in the Navy.
Yeah.
My dad was in the Navy during Vietnam and this guy, you guys are all the same. I'm just going to say this. You guys remember every detail, who you were with, what car you were driving, who farted out the window, you know what I mean? Who flicked a cigarette at somebody in the eye, like every little detail, every story, every name. It's amazing. Because when I hear you guys talk, I hear my dad, you know what I mean? Even though he was only in it for 4 years, but... just the stories and the stories and the stories. And it's like, sounds like half the time, the stories are like goofing off. Like there was nothing, like they never talk about any of the, you know, the war,
well,
you know.
That's the Navy, you know, you can't compare.
Well, they were the Uber for Air Force, right? So,
Well, the Air Force the same way. When my two buddies were here on my birthday a year or so ago, we talked a lot about, but we didn't really talk about offensives and defenses and what we actually did. We talked about fixing airplanes, because we all worked on F-4s.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy, the big guy, had 30, he was trying to get over 30. He had 30 years in. And he was in Vietnam when we wasn't supposed to be there. So he could really tell you some more stories.
Yeah, let's get Jimmy
on the phone. Let me say, he could tell you he was there, but he can't
tell you why.
So you said he was trying for 30?
Yeah, he wanted to go. No, he did 30. He wanted to go over 30 if he could.
They told him no?
They wouldn't know. No, 30 is top cat. The
really?
Only person who can go over 30 is a...
like a general or something?
Chief Master Sergeant. And Jimmy didn't make chief. He made E-8, Senior Master Sergeant.
Right.
So walk us through that process of, you know, getting to Chief Master Sergeant. How long did it take for you to get to Chief Master? And then how many levels did, you know, you said stripe. I'm sorry. How many stripes did you obtain for the Chief Master Sergeant? Because there's different.
Eight stripes. That's as high as you can get okay. in the Air Force. Eight. It's a Chief Master Sergeant in the Air Force. It's like a Sergeant Major in the Marines. The Marines in the Army or a Master Chief in the Navy. That's the top of the enlisted rank. And
Did you get awarded any medals or citations during that time?
When I have my uniform on, it's about halfway up my chest.
Really? Wow. That's awesome.
But I was considered a fast burner only because I was lucky. And I would tell you my nickname when I crewed, but there's a young lady here. So
I'm sure she's heard that.
She's probably so.
But I love my aircraft, and I was very particular about who worked on it and how they worked the did on my aircraft when I was assigned to one.
Oh, so you actually flew too?
I have flown in the F-4, the F-15, the A-10.
Tell us what that is like. That's got to be some kind of rush, man.
It is a rush. Especially if you have a front seater that's what we consider a jock.
Yeah.
And the bet was a case of beer Normandy that he'd get you sick.
puke in the back.
Yeah, and give you a couple of barf bags.
Yeah, nobody wants to smell that on the flight back.
No. You had to clean it up if you did it, you know. Okay, but yeah, I love it. I can't describe it. You think a roller coaster or something, get on there, F-15 and double burners coming off the runway, and he holds it on deck as you watch the airspeed going up, 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 and you're hitting someplace around 650, 700 knots, and he yanks the thing straight up. And your G-load, you just...
Your
G-suit inflates around your legs to keep the blood from...
Head. Your balls are in your throat.
And then he gets up top and he flips it over. And
that sounds so cool, though. Okay, I want to do that.
That sounds great.
I want to do that. What's your problem?
One hell of a ride.
Oh, I'd for sure puke. Don't get me wrong. I would puke sitting in the backseat of a car. Yeah. So
you wouldn't hack this one.
No, yeah. Motion sickness is not my thing.
Man, that had to be, you know, it's really cool that, you know, I guess that's a perk, more or less, right? I mean, Not a perk, but, you know, it's a cool thing you got to do.
Yeah, and that wasn't an everyday thing.
Right.
Oh, no.
That's what I'm saying. No. It was kind of a
actually,
perk.
Actually, they cut it out after a while. We had an airman went up and won. I think he was in California, and the jet crashed, and his parents got really upset.
Oh, no. Yeah. And the government got probably sued.
I don't know if you can sue the government.
That wouldn't work very well.
I think
but
they make more
money
than most.
Get some benefits that they normally wouldn't get.
Yeah, exactly. But go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, it's funny that you say that you got to where you were out of luck, because my grandpa was in the Navy, and he used to say the same thing, where he was like, I was just standing in the right place, and they just grabbed the first person that saw me, and he was one of the first people that did radar in World War II, oddly enough, and it was just because
really?
He was just standing
That's
there.
Exciting.
Yeah, and I can't remember exactly what he was before, but his boss just, like, turned to him and was like, hey, go do this, and he was like, okay, and he used to always say it was honestly just luck that how I got where I was. He's like, I can't describe it, it's just luck.
Like a lot of life in general is like that, right?
Sometimes, you know, sometimes you'd be in the right place at the right time, or, you know, in the wrong place at the wrong time.
True.
You know,
you've got to make your career. Yeah. It's like any other career that you go into. You've got to put your heart to it. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to put your heart to it, you shouldn't be there. You know, don't do something you don't really love.
Right. As you moved up the rankings, do you have to be appointed, or do you have to test to move up? I don't. You know.
Okay. Every annually, you'd get a performance review by your superior, and then that would be endorsed by. Three people. And those endorsements mean a lot. And then you also have to test all the way up, all stripes you test for. And both military history, your job, you test in all those areas. It's about four or five volumes you study. I don't know what it is today, but I'm talking about when I was in. And of course, those performance reports mean a lot. And you got to keep your nose clean. Don't get any Article 15s, which is a bad boy. Uniform Code of Military Justice bust, or anything like that. And then the performance reports really mean a lot because that counts. And then medals, if you're awarded because of your achievement or things that you've done, those medals, each one of them count differently. Of course, the Medal of Honor is the highest, Congressional Medal of Honor. Mm-hmm. And then under that is the Silver Star and Air Force Cross.
You said there are some Purple Hearts in your family. Was there any Medal of Honors in
no. Silver Star is my father's the highest. Wow. That was next to the
Now, as a chief master, did you do any battle planning or anything like that?
As I mentioned earlier, when I was over in Europe, I was matter of fact, I was fortunate. I was on the Inspector General team as a aircraft maintenance inspector for the command, and I worked with NATO on the NATO TACAVAL team. And I was really fortunate to be assigned to work with headquarters, U.S. Air Forces Europe and NATO, on battle plans for Middle East.
Oh, wow, yeah.
But
how was that?
It was great. It was exciting. We did planning and all kind of things, but unfortunately, there was a general that saw me when I was out of the Air Force working as we called him Feather Mertens or contractor, or deal, you know. And he walked up to me and he remembered me. And he said, you know what? Remember all that work? We didn't use any of it.
wait. The government's wasting our money?
Well, no, it wasn't the military's idea. It's that wonderful thing called Congress.
Yeah. That's
now, so you went to Europe.
Yes.
And then on your last day there.
Yep.
And, you know, you come back. What did you do? Like those first few weeks, you're back and you're now a civilian. How was that experience?
That's tough because you first place you don't have to get up on dark 30 and put on a uniform, and your mindset is more relaxed because being in the military you have a set of a code that you follow. Right. You know, it's changed a lot since when I was in, but you know, because I retired in 1988. So things have changed quite a bit, but it was kind of difficult for me because to this day I go out to Luke Air Force Base and get out of the car and smell jet fuel fumes because I was around most of my career.
Nostalgia, you get the
But it was tough. It did take long to get into the mold, but you always question what you see people do. Like I'd go to work. And I'd see some of the people I was working with at this company, and you'd say, why is he standing over there and not doing his job?
Yeah, because he doesn't have a chief master yelling at him to do it.
So what did you do after? What was the career that you pursued after when you
came back? I stayed in aviation for most of for a long time.
Oh, okay.
I came back, and I went back to school first because knowing that I'd been out of away, I got my degrees through Amarillo in the military.
Okay.
And after I got out, I said, you know what, I need to take a math to get up to speed on the modern math and the things that changed, technical writing. And then I took a physical geography for fun because I love science. I'm big on earth sciences. And then I took creative writing because I had to go into a civilian kind of world, and that's a lot different writing than military tongue and quill type of thing. And so I did those courses at a local college here in Phoenix. Mm-hmm. Enjoyed it.
You say you go out to...
My students, they hated me because I set the curve.
Wait, so you said you go out to Luke Air Force Base every now and then. So are there moments where you miss it?
Oh, every day.
Every day.
I always miss it. I think it's ingrained in me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you hear that a lot from people that they miss it.
Did you see those... At my birthday party, the two guys were with me. Did you see the kind of camaraderie that's
really you'd think they were still in there. You would think that the way they were drinking and talking, that these were 30-year-old guys.
Do you guys have, like, outside of, you know, reunions were there, but are there any, like, official reunions that you attend?
I haven't attended any of them. Okay. There is squadron and wing reunions. They make it time frame, right? Because, you know, a wing could last for 30 years. Mm-hmm. They say, if you're stationed in the 4th TAC Fighter Wing in Cameron Bay, Vietnam, during this period of time, we're going to have a reunion in Las Vegas.
Wow.
Someplace. So you mentioned that the wings don't last forever. Do they
and go
retire. Based on...
They retire wings.
Are they based on locations?
No, it's really based on the wing's history. If you have a... for instance, let me give you a good... that's really Marines, Pappy Boyington and the Black Sheep.
Right.
Remember that?
But is it the same for them?
Well, what happened was they retired it, and then it came back in as a fighter squadron, and we had F-15s in the Black Sheep Squadron, which before it was the...
So why do they retire then? Just not needed
just
anymore?
Just not needed. The number of wings have been reduced because of Congress. And when you reduce that many wings, you don't really need all the...
Is there a set number of planes for a wing?
Normally it's 72. That's the normal, they call it utilized equipment rate.
Okay.
Normally.
What would you say, or how did the experience affect or influence your life and your the life after serving?
I'm a little different than a lot of guys. I kind of take it to heart. I try to live by the code. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'm not very successful at that. But...
You know, your daughter says the same thing. She's like, I'm not like other people either. I'm like, okay, it is a Cummings thing.
Yeah.
I'm just...
It's your experience in the service drives how you get out and do things. If you talk to I have a chance because my wife and I go to the veteran, a VA, mm-hmm. For a lot of our medical care and hearing aids and things like that. And when we go out there, I enjoy sitting out there for the hour wait, talking to Marines and Army and Navy guys from all different branches. I had a chance recently to talk to a guy that was one of the first to land at Omaha Beach.
Oh, wow.
And he was sitting there in a wheelchair.
How
and
he old? Was he's in his hundreds.
Did he lie and get in at 12? I mean, that was 45, right?
Yeah.
No, 40.
He was old. His son had brought him out there. I think it might have been his grandson, to tell you the truth. Wow. But we talked for a few minutes. And one reason I noticed the ribbons on him. He had the Second World War ribbon. There's a guy that he's seen a lot.
I can imagine.
That would have been... A horrible experience.
Yeah.
So do you ever, like when you go to the VA or anything, when you're talking to, you know, some of the veterans, do you, like some of the younger kids that might be suffering from like PTSD or do you try to, like, I don't want to use the word mentor, but like try to stay in touch with them to try to help them out? If, you know, I guess supports it.
You've got to be careful doing that, Tim, because you don't know how the VA is treating that patient.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And if you jump into it and bring in your experience or something, you could actually be counterproductive, especially when you have mental disorders like that. Mm-hmm. That same condition goes way back to the First World War. Yeah. I mean, that's nothing new.
They used to call it shell shock.
Yeah, shell shock. That's right.
I've heard that they've removed the D on that. They don't want to call it a disorder anymore.
Right.
It's just post-traumatic stress is what they call it now.
Yeah. So the doctor that I work for does like a lot of like, he's the one for the UFC fights and the boxing fights. Hmm. And he does like a lot of the smaller UFC fights as well. And I would assist him every once in a while during it because there's just never enough hands there, of course. And there was a patient that had PTSD. And for whatever reason, his therapist decided it was a good idea for him to go into like fighting and be put into like those violent, stressful situations because it's almost like it is kind of a mystery, like where everybody's different, but also like the main way to treat it right now is basically exposure on some level, but it's more of exposure of what had happened, not necessarily exposure to new triggers. Mm-hmm. But the poor kid went in there and he froze completely. And for the doctor to go into the ring, the ref has to allow him to. Mm-hmm. And the ref didn't allow him to. And this poor kid got the snot beat out of him.
Oh, wow.
And I just remember it was the saddest thing I've ever seen because he was not responding. And you would think as the other fighter, you'd be like, like maybe I should stop. Or I don't know, of course, because I'm not a boxer. You know what I mean? And I'm not in UFC, but I felt so bad for the kid. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those things that there really is no right way of treating it. Everybody responds differently.
Right.
And it's still one of those things that not a lot of therapists are really trained in how to treat it either.
Mm-hmm.
There's only that's actually something that's like really semi-controversial right now because there's not a guarantee as to treatment. And there's not enough therapists that know how to treat it either.
Well, unfortunately, the VA is losing some of their depth because some of the that has experienced combat are retiring or getting out of the service, and now you're having civilian doctors trying to treat it, and they don't understand what happened or what he could have experienced.
Yeah,
and that It's tough.
And the doctor that I work under, he was in the military. I can't remember what branch he was under. Why am I blanking on this now? I think he was in the Navy, if I remember right. But yeah, it is one of those things where it's tough because, again, the doctors don't really, like, they're civilians, so they don't understand, like, the full.
Right.
You can try, but.
I think what you really got to consider when you talk about military and Memorial Day, just to kind of revert back a little bit, each military person is going to look at it differently. Did they experience death while they were in the service? Or did they lose a family member or a loved one? Or do they know of someone that was close to them that lost a loved one in the war? You have a different outlook or a different perspective of what Memorial Day means. To me, Memorial Day is bigger. I helped pull some guys off of choppers that they didn't make it. And I actually conducted CPR on two people. And no, we did not have those pretty masks and everything. We used a cloth. Mm-hmm. But when you think back to that, I think about the guys that were lost, and I lost my pilots and those people. But you also think about those people that were wounded and their whole life is crushed. Memorial Day to me means more than just those that lost their life. Someday you go out to the VA on Indian School and go back to the ward where they're having guys that are in conditions of mental disorder or mental stress and have physical disabilities caused by conflicts. Mm-hmm. And you say, that's who we need to remember because they gave up part of their life. Their life is
their
gone.
Life,
even
yeah.
they're living,
yeah.
but whatever they wanted to do, whatever their goals were, is shattered.
Right.
And that's what you got to remember in Memorial Day.
Yeah. I think that's a good summary to this interview. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
For joining us. I think that's going to do it for us. We're hitting that hour, but I think something that we can all do this weekend before or after we spend time with family is to find an organization and donate. There's a lot of organizations out there that are doing great work and great work for folks who served and even their families. And so I'm going to list out some of these organizations and you go out and do your research on them. But these are six good organizations. One of them is Homes for Our Troops. There's also Navy Marine Corps Relief Society. The Wounded Warrior Project, Hope for the Warriors, and then there's Fisher House Foundation, and then the last one is the Memorial Day Foundation. So again, thank you for coming on to the show. I'm gonna go ahead and play a video that I saw, and it's actually a pretty good video on a Memorial Day speech given by one of the presidents, and this was maybe I think back when you retired. So I'm gonna go ahead and play it and let you guys watch it.
If we look to the answer as to why for so many years we achieved so much, prospered as no other people on earth, it was because here in this land, we unleashed the energy and individual genius of man to a greater extent than has ever been done before. Freedom and the dignity of the individual have been more available and assured here than in any other place on earth. The price for this freedom at times has been high, but we have never been unwilling to pay that price. Those who say that we're in a time when there are no heroes, they just don't know where to look. The sloping hills of Arlington National Cemetery, with its row upon row of simple white markers bearing crosses or stars of David, they add up to only a tiny fraction of the price that has been paid for our freedom. Each one of those markers is a monument to the kind of hero I spoke of earlier. Their lives ended in places called Belleau Wood, the Argonne, Omaha Beach, Salerno, and halfway around the world on Guadalcanal, Tarawa, Porkchop Hill, the Chosin Reservoir, and in 100 rice paddies and jungles of a place called Vietnam. Under one such marker lies a young man, Martin Treptow, who left his job in a small town barber shop in 1917 to go to France with the famed Rainbow Division. there on the Western Front. He was killed trying to carry a message between battalions under heavy artillery fire. We're told that on his body was found a diary. On the flyleaf, under the heading My Pledge, he had written these words: America must win this war. Therefore, I will work, I will save, I will sacrifice, I will endure. I will fight cheerfully and do my utmost as if the issue of the whole struggle depended on me alone. We must realize that no arsenal or no weapon in the arsenals of the world is so formidable as the will and moral courage of free men and women. It is a weapon our adversaries in today's world do not have. It is a weapon that we as Americans do have. Let that be understood by those who practice terrorism and prey upon their neighbors. As for the enemies of freedom, those who are potential adversaries, they will be reminded that peace is the highest aspiration of the American people. We will negotiate for it, sacrifice for it. We will not surrender for it now or ever. We are Americans.
All right, thank you, everybody. And we're off, and we'll see you guys next week. Enjoy your weekend.
All right.
Thank you. Peace.
Have a good one.
All right.